Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
I did get to Staten Island to the conference on R.D. Lang in the 21st century, which turned out to be in part a conference on existentialism in psychology and philosophy because R.D. Lang drew a lot on that. It was a really lovely event. I got to meet some very good people and to see some old friends from around the world. And I want to thank those of you who listened to my promoting it on the show and who came and said hello. I want to thank you for coming. Met, among others, Fritzhof Capra. Some of you may remember from the 60s, his best-selling Tao of Physics. He's still writing about science and the human spirit. And it was really a delight to hear him speak and to meet with him as well. And professors from Wagner College. Things are changing out there. There's just no doubt that people on every level, from ordinary folks to professors, who, of course, turn out to be ordinary folks, are realizing that psychiatry is a growing menace, that there's much too much psychiatric drugging going on. The world is catching on, but keep in mind, we can't expect psychiatry to catch on because it's not in their self-interest at all to have an enlightened population concerning the risks of psychiatric drugs and the availability of much, much better alternatives. My guest today, I'm really looking forward to. Cheryl, are you there? We hooked in
here.
From Canada. Oh, well,
yes,
that's great.
Yes, here I am.
Wonderful, wonderful. My guest is Cheryl Van Dalen Smith. Her last name is spelled D-A-A-L-E-N-Smith, Van Dalen Smith. Cheryl is an associate professor in the School of Nursing and the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University in Toronto. And she's also director of the graduate program in interdisciplinary studies. Oh, she's such an unusual academician. She has a heart. She cares. She has purposes. She wants to do good on the universe. Although we've never met personally, I don't believe, we have corresponded so much that I think we both feel like we're old friends and good friends and mutually respectful colleagues as well. I got to know Cheryl Van Dalen Smith when she called me to ask me if I'd give her some feedback on an article that she and a group of others were writing on shock treatment in children. And I was happy to, and as it progressed, I said I'd be happy to be one of the authors. And so I became a joint author two or three down the line on a forthcoming article that she can tell you more about. Cheryl, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Tell us more about yourself. You know, I can give a little more introduction. I mean, Cheryl really is on the cutting edge of children's issues, women's issues. She really wants to give voice to the people who don't have voice. And maybe that's just enough of an intro. And tell us about your work, and let's get off and running about what you do.
Sure. Thank you so much for this opportunity, too, Peter. And you're right. You know, we've had an awful lot of correspondence and lots of phone calls early in the morning, late at night, and you've always been someone that I've wanted to meet, and to be able to work with you has really just been a treasure. You know, as a nurse, one of the things I learned early as a nurse is that we're called to make a difference, and that if we bear witness to something, that it behooves us to speak up and speak out. But early on, I realized that the climate within which nurses are expected to work wasn't conducive to that call or that ethical responsibility, if you will. I remember very early in my nursing career, I wanted to be a pediatric nurse, and so I was one, and was working in a tertiary care center, and as a new nurse was required to do a lot of the admissions. And the unit I was on happened to be a unit where we admitted children with life-threatening illnesses, cancer-based. And I kept noticing the same or similar geographic area that so many of the children being admitted for ALL or AML, can't remember which leukemia it was, were coming from a certain geographic area. And, of course, in nursing, we're supposed to pay attention to patterns, look for patterns. Well, there was a pattern in my face, and, you know, naively thought people would want to know this, so took it to the head nurse at the time, and I remember it like it was yesterday, being brought to the dirty utility room, not the clean utility room, because there's too much ears there, and told to not say anything. Do not say a word at all. Now, later on, I came to realize that actually a lot of the admissions were coming from a neighborhood near a nuclear reactor site. But that was 15 years later. But at the time, the message of silencing was so strong. I just remember that. That was sort of my entree into realizing that there was more pressure to be quiet than there was to speak up and speak out. But, you know, having said that, it didn't stop me because something deep inside of you forces you to say this isn't right. There's something that isn't right. And I remember being a nursing student and accompanying a person for ECT. I don't like to call it ECT because I don't believe it's therapeutic. And my responsibility at the time was to hold the head and insert the tongue depressor and all the rest. And I remember trembling and feeling traumatized, and feeling that I was, of course, now my language would be complicit, but that in some way I had just participated in something barbaric. And but I didn't feel safe saying anything because I was being evaluated. It was a placement, and there just seemed to be an unspoken expectation to be a team player, to go along with Doctor Knows Best team. You know, the care plan is already set. You're just a lowly student. And those two things really stuck with me when I was thinking about how it was that I ended up being where I am now. And then, you know, my jobs have been, my positions have been quite varied. So working in a tertiary care center, a pediatric nurse, and then working as a school nurse, so a public health nurse in Canada. And in that role, one of the many privileges in that role is that you get to see the world at people's coffee tables, if you will. You're invited into their home for whatever it is. Perhaps it's teaching around diabetes, or it's supportive counseling around perhaps a person living with another person with an addiction, or whatever it is, transition issues, or you know, how health is anything from the petri dish to poverty and everything in between. So public health nurses at the time were seeing everything along that spectrum, if you will. But in so doing, you know, I started to notice a lot. I started to notice what I now understand to be marginalization, what I now understand to be voicelessness. And at one point in my career, I remember that there was a big push in public health. It started in California and made it into Canada, of course, around self-esteem. But we've got to get more people feeling better about themselves. And that is really what I started to explore around women's sense of self, women's self-esteem, and the programs that were in place to attempting to change that. And that ended up being my master's thesis, and for people who are wanting to look at that, the publication is called Shifting the Lens. And in that, what I did was I spent time observing public health-run self-esteem groups that were held in malls or plazas, And then for some of the people that were participating, they were all women, participating, did they ever want to sit and have a one-to-one with me? So what I did, I observed the groups, and then I had one-to-one interviews with the women, and then six of the women and I moved and had a retreat where we tried to shift the lens placed on women's self-esteem, because what I discovered was well-intentioned professionals were unwittingly placing the responsibility for having low self-esteem on the shoulders of the person themselves. And almost the message was, you know, why do you do this to yourself? Why are you thinking this way? We just need to change your inner sort of languaging. But there wasn't any sociocultural analysis of how the women ended up feeling lousy. What was it? And in interviewing the women and then having the retreat, it was across the board situations of being dismissed, devalued, judged, objectified, infantilized, having needs unmet, and of course gender role expectations, which I think affect boys and girls, men and women, so much. I think that's so limiting. So that was my master's, where we tried to shift the lens and refocus on the best way to support people's sense of self is to help them look into the broader social context so that they understood there wasn't something intrinsically wrong with them. There wasn't a flaw. There wasn't a deficit. At the same time, nursing was moving towards nursing diagnoses, eh? And one of them was something like self-esteem disorders or self-deprecating disorder, and I said to my colleagues, this sounds like the DSM. This sounds like we're trying to replicate, you know, categorizing people and from a deficit lens. And so, yeah, I don't know if I should stop there for now. If you wanted to ask me something, I feel like I'm saying too much.
No, you're doing fine. I always feel free to interrupt.
Oh, good.
And there was no need to interrupt.
Okay.
I want people to really get a sense of who you are and what you're doing.
Okay.
Because I really value your viewpoint. Let's talk some more about girls and what they go through, and also about how it reflects on boys. And then maybe in the second half hour, we'll come back to maybe shock treatment and psychiatric drugs. But let's continue with your thoughts about the girls and also boys. And obviously the injury to girls turns out ultimately to also injure boys, because any disequilibrium in power and self-worth affects both the victim and the person who is seemingly gaining the power.
Yeah.
Is that clear?
Yeah. No, I think what I want to say is just how gender role expectations limit girls' sense of self. The limit is on how boys and girls do masculinity and do femininity. And, you know, it came really clear to me when I began to study anger, but I'll talk about that in a minute. So, you know, I do, all my work is on girls and women, but I'm, you know, if I was younger, I think I would start looking at boys. Because as a school nurse, you know, when I would finally get to see a young man who was struggling, which was quite rare, because again, social expectations are you don't come forward, you're fine, you're good, you're tough, you suck it up. And I remember one situation where, as a school nurse, I asked for my office to be in between the two vice principals' offices, because they had a little cubby there. I said, that's the best place for me. Why do you want to be there? And I said, because I think that when kids are in trouble, they're actually troubled. So how about I hang out in this area? Well, good thing, because one time there was a young man who was in trouble, you know, F you to all the teachers and throwing things in gym and whatever. And he was on his last chance, I guess, and he was going to be turfed. And I remember saying, can I talk to him? Would you mind? Yeah, if you want to talk to him, go ahead. But he's gone. He's gone at noon. So I sat beside him, and of course, who's this old lady? You know, who's this sitting beside me? Because he was very, very angry. So I did what we're supposed to do, health professionals, and that's try to earn trust, not assume that I get to have any trust, but try to earn some. And luckily, he was open in the moment. Well, what had happened, this is no surprise to you, Dr. Bregan, but what had happened was he had experienced something hugely traumatic, yet felt silenced, felt really unable to come forward about it for all the reasons of gender role expectations. You know, you're supposed to be tough. And he had been hitchhiking. He accepted a ride from someone, and the guy raped him. So he, because of systemic homophobia, didn't want to come forward and tell anybody. He did tell somebody, I can't remember, I think an uncle, and got the same sort of response that girls will get. You know, why did you go in the car? Why didn't you fight the guy off? And so this young man was fearful not only of being blamed, but also, again, because of homophobia, being seen as gay. And so, but I never got to see him. They had been working with him or giving him trouble or suspending him for 6 months. But because, I keep repeating it, but because it's not cool to come forward as a guy, especially in high school, he was suffering in silence, and the only way he knew was to externalize. Whereas a lot of the girls I would see would internalize. So we'd see depression, we'd see some cutting, we'd see sort of more internalizing their feelings, where we see lots of externalizing in guys. But it gets masked, eh? I just love William Pollack's work in the States around boys and boyhood and the whole mask of masculinity. And it's been very influential, not only in my teaching at the university, but also in the way I've tried to support boys and young men as a nurse. So that's what I want to say about gender roles. When it came to girls, a lot of my clientele, if you will, as a school nurse, was girls and young women. I think they were more often referred to me and also more often felt comfortable coming forward. But I remember once there was a measles outbreak in Ontario, and so all the public health nurses were pulled from their schools, from what we typically do, sort of classes or community development work or supportive counseling one-to-one and lots of referrals to mental health professionals or addiction or whatever it was that we were doing. So we were pulled and we were giving immunizations. And I remember one of the questions was, this was in the 90s, not too long ago, are you on a medication or have you been recently prescribed a medication? And in close to the 80 percentile, I didn't do the math, but close to the 80 percentile, girls were either on some sort of a psychotropic medication or had been prescribed it in the last 6 months to a year, in the 80 percentile. And that is what birthed my PhD work, because it was niggling away at me to the point where I couldn't sleep, that I'm thinking now pharmaceuticals are targeting girls. Now they're going for youth. This is way before the DSM-5, of course, where they're targeting children. Now they're going for girls, and it almost seemed like a rite of passage that they're on this and that. And at the time, Paxil was big, really, really big. Prozac was really, really big. So when I moved into that kind of work, thinking that I was going to do some sort of an expose on the numbers of girls being placed on psychotropic meds, And what I did when I went into the literature is, for some reason, anger kept coming out. Anger, because I was trying to figure out what's bringing girls to their family physician's office in the first place. What's going on? And so I started to study anger and, of course, came to see that most of the literature was on teaching kids to manage their anger, still viewing anger as a sin, and still equating it with aggression when we know that anger is an emotion and aggression is a behavior. But the mushing of the two, so the message was, don't be angry. So that's how I moved into my PhD research, where I interviewed 65 girls and young women across Canada, did focus groups with 7 or 8 diverse groups of girls, from rural girls to First Nations Native girls to a black single mums, it's not my label, that was the label of the group, to girls living with spina bifida, that's a queer group, and a couple of other sort of mainstream hegemonic groups. And from those focus groups, I came to realize that not only did the girls not really have language to talk about anger, that they hadn't had an opportunity to speak about it from an anger-affirming stance. They weren't permitted to embrace that emotion, to see it as a message, as a gift, if you will, that there's something wrong in their emotional surround. And from there, I then interviewed, I think, 11 of the girls more intensively, and they did, because they were having trouble coming to language about anger, we moved to sort of art-based stuff or different ways to open them up and get them chatting about, what led to their anger, what were their life circumstances leading to anger, what were they permitted to do with anger, and we discovered that catch-22, right? That if they did speak of their anger, and I'm not saying toss things or, you know, wrecked a room. I'm saying if they merely said, when that happened, I felt, or when you did this, I felt, that it always disrupted relationships, and resulted in loss, more loss, resulted in them being pathologized even more, as seen as flawed, seen as a little bit whacked. There's that good old work of Dorothy Smith said, I'm not mad, I'm angry. And so in doing that work, and I've been sort of through the United States talking about it and a little bit through Canada talking about it with school nurses, what I'm trying to do is help people, actually help girls and young women voice their anger, because it's underneath it is hurt, underneath it is dismissed needs, dismissed distress. And otherwise, more and more girls and young women will end up on drugs, will end up in this pill for every ill mentality, where we're selling the notion of, if you don't feel well, take this pill, because it's your chemistry. There's something wrong with your chemistry. Not one of those 65 girls had something wrong with their chemistry. It wasn't something inside their biological selves. It was something or a series of things that had happened to them that then got dismissed and squished down. One girl, I remember, had been acquaintance raped by her boyfriend, who had just broke up with her, by her boyfriend's best friend, who said, I'll walk her home. And he raped her against a tree while she was crying with her mascara all over the face about just being dropped. When she started to speak about it at school, of course, everybody called her a whore. You brought it on yourself. And, that's just one of the stories, just one of the stories of dismissed anger. And that she was suggested to be put on a medication. So really all of my work, and I know in the second half we'll talk about electroshock and how that happened, but all of it has come from witnessing something. It wasn't sort of sitting around saying, what do I think I want to do an inquiry into? It was always something I've seen that then bothered me on a moral level that I felt called to try and tell the truths of people who otherwise aren't heard or aren't believed. Yeah, so that's what I'll say about that.
Well, it's, I think, incredibly important. One of the surprises that I had early in my clinical work was, having patients come to me who were very basically quiet and shy young women, and in talking with them about their feelings, discovering the amount of suppressed rage there was in many people, because people don't like to be quiet and shy. They don't want to be valued for being quiet and shy. And there's a lot of hurt behind being quiet and shy. And as you said, the hurt is what's really there, deepest inside. But the anger is the first thing you run into one of the first things if you actually begin exploring with people, why are they behaving in a submissive way or a shy manner. And that's been an important lesson for me early on. That
submissive thing, that's so troubling to me, that submissive thing, because I'm happier if they're throwing things and mad and behaving in some sort of an aggressive way. I'm way more worried when it's they've moved into that self-silencing. Even that word I don't like, because it suggests that the person herself or himself is making a choice to, quote, self-silence. But when this model that came out of this research showed me that this lose-lose, if you speak it, it ends up still that you're going to doubt yourself because of the response you get of there's something wrong with you, or why are you such a drama queen? Why can't you just let that go? It happened 2 years ago. You know, why are you still grieving for those three babies you lost? Or whatever it is, it ended up teaching the girls that I interviewed to shut up. In other words, to stuff it down and to self-silence. If they did speak of it, the end result, again, was more silencing of the self, silencing of one's authentic voice at the cost of a relationship. So above all else, I must make relationships work, because that's really the most important thing about me. Otherwise, I'm a bitch, pardon my language, or I'm a mental case, or, you know, now of course the whole language around anger. Any woman who's angry is often diagnosed with borderline. So, that thing about being submissive. About anger. I wanted to tell you this before the break, and that is, I learned something by default about anger. I learned that anger is the one emotion denied of women and the one emotion permitted of men.
That's powerful.
It is. And when we talk about it, you realize how much these gender straitjackets limit men, limit women, hurt relationships, you know, hurt children, we were given this emotion and the whole other bag of emotions to use to help us navigate through the world. We need anger. We need fear. We need joy. We need all of them. The only emotion denied of women and the only emotion permitted of men.
When we come back, I'd actually like to just continue this conversation about boys and girls and men and women. You know, our article on ECT that I think you're the senior author on, that'll be coming out when? Quite a ways down the line, in 6 months or something. I can have you back then to talk about it. Let's go along now and talk about more and more about what you have devoted so much of your life to. After the break, I want you to respond to what to me is has been a difficult issue, one that I was talking with a professor who teaches about boys and men. He has one of the few boys and men courses in the country, he said.
Yeah.
Very sensitive man. And what he was saying is that, well, feminism had done a great deal in empowering women, and he really favored the overall movement, that it was also confusing to boys and to some degree undermining boys and men. So I'd like you to address that, which I think is an interesting and important issue. And let's just keep talking about these issues that you are so good at. And we can have you back, if we don't get to it, to talk about shock treatment and drugs further.
Yeah.
So let's go to break, and I look forward to a hearing from Dr. Cheryl Van Dalen Smith when we return. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin with my marvelous, dedicated guest. Really, Cheryl.
You're so good for me.
Cheryl Van Dalen Smith. Oh, the whole world should be good for you, Cheryl.
Aw, thank you.
Oh, gosh. So I've invited Cheryl to address a question which will actually come up in a future show on boys and men about whether she sees any aspects of feminism as becoming suppressive, basically, of boys and men. Cheryl, What are your feelings about that?
Yeah, I'm also a children's studies teacher. I didn't sort of say what I'm doing at the university, but I actually, and also my under minors in my grad programs, both grad programs was women's studies. So I do not feel that women's studies has suppressed. I think we have ignored. And I think that it's time for women's studies to birth. Well, that's probably not a good metaphor. It's a little essentialist, but to give way to many more programs that look at boys and young men. I think that's the problem. Now, I don't know if it's William Pollack that you're having on. I know that Pollack...
No, it's not.
Oh, he's a terrific guy. But I have seen a lot of the work looking at reviving Ophelia and then the flip of that saying, what about Hamlet, and, you know, going on that sort of literary metaphor. But I don't believe that it is women's studies or a feminist movement who has done this to boys. I think society has gendered boys and girls in a way that is so troublingly limiting. Like, there's myths about boys, that boys are toxic, that boys will be boys, that, you know, unless you really watch out, that most men can be violent, you know, they're underneath it all, they're really just sort of an animal, and driven by their sexuality and cry for power and all of this. I don't think all of that damage has come from feminism. What I think hasn't been helpful is that myself as a women's studies scholar has not dedicated enough time to looking at boys' issues and men's issues. That doesn't mean that I want to erode women's studies as a space, but even at York University, we've moved to now gender, sexuality, and women's studies, so that we're beginning to look at, not beginning, we're looking at gender more broadly. We're also looking at gender that's fluid, and we have one of the few courses, I guess, that unpacks masculinity. Finally. So I would like to see children's studies programs, you know, I have a course on girlhood. I would like to see a course on boyhood that really critically unpacks the way that we apply gender rules to XY and XX chromosomes. You know, what are we doing to perpetuate this? That, I think, is the injustice that we're all contributing to. So I personally don't buy, and I'm not trying to be defensive because I'm the first to say we've ignored boys, but I don't believe that in pointing out patriarchy that's oppressed boys and men. I don't think so. I think I like to point to social systems that create problems. Racism, homophobia, sizism, sexism, and all those better than, less than binaries that are out there that make boys feel like crap and make girls feel like crap. And, you know, hurt people, Bill Cosby said, which is so true. So we have to move from a society that's such a hurting society. We're a poisonous society, the way that we gender boys and girls. And this whole big movement of princesses and warriors that's back in the stupid toy stores, and all you have to see is Halloween and see what we're telling boys you can be and should be, and what we're telling girls you can be and should be. So, yeah.
Well, these are complicated issues. Can I go forward with a little bit more of my questioning about it?
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be the best answerer, but I'll give it a go.
I don't know if I'm going to be the best questioner. I think that some of the concerns have been, first, and this is not nearly so much anymore, but just the amount of anger that was shown toward men in the earlier years of the feminist movement. You know, we can do without them. We can just have one man inseminating 50 women kind of viewpoint. That was somewhat there in academia and certainly in writings. But the concern's a little different than the one you're expressing. I think that some folks, and I certainly have questions about this, and I know my wife Ginger does, about whether or not the problems we've inflicted upon women in terms of disempowering them haven't become more inflicted upon men as well, on boys as well, when we, in our schools and other institutions, disempower the strength of boys, the anger of boys, the leadership of, that boys have, and even the fact that boys do at times have to learn to fight. So I'm just wondering whether are we on a different, do we disagree somewhere in there, which would be fine.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm interested in that whole line of argument as well. I don't criticize that at all. I just think we need to revamp everything. And, you know, we had a set of parents in Toronto who chose to raise their child. They named their child Storm, and they chose to raise their child without a gender, without disclosing to anybody the gender of that child. And the storm, if you will, that came about from that. But it's an interesting social experiment trying to look at the way that we genderfy, which is not a good word, babies from the very moment. I don't know. I think boys are struggling in school. The overdiagnosis of so-called ADHD or behavior and onto the Ritalin and placing them in classes and calling them learning disabled and such is so problematic. It's just so problematic.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
It's psychiatrizing boys who, you know, I'm into that nature-nurture debate. I believe that there's a combination of the two at play. And, you know, I have a rescue farm, and I see differences in sex of animals and behavior. I see it. It's not, and no one said to them, hey, you need to be a good girl goat, and you need to be kind and get along with people, and you know, saying something to the boy alpaca. I see it. No matter what species I have on this rescue farm, I'm seeing gender, I'm seeing, you know, nature differences. And I think boys need to move in school. We need to not be so language-based, we need to be more activity-based. And then we tell them, hey, sit down, be quiet, pay attention. And when they don't or can't, you know, because what do we have, 15 minutes for recess, and we take away the balls because someone might get hurt, and then we say, oh, you have a, you know, attention deficit, or you have a behavior problem, so, you know, we're going to put you on Ritalin. That's just so troubling.
These are really interesting issues, and they're so complicated, the whole gender role.
Yeah.
One of the things you said, by the way, the first half hour, I don't know if I can get it exactly, but it was so marvelous when you said that anger is the one emotion forbidden to women and the only one allowed to men.
Yep.
I think tells a huge, huge story. I really appreciate that hugely. In the anecdotes you were giving about how a couple of anecdotes about women being raped and then being blamed and being told to get over it and so on. Mm-hmm. Feminism, has accomplished a lot in alerting society to the abuse of women and children, to the sexual abuse of women and children. I think it's been on the cutting edge of influencing society to appreciate those issues. Do you think much has changed from the way you were talking? Not much has changed. Do you think much has changed in terms of the police and educators and other people taking more seriously the abuse of women and children in particular?
I do. I just think it's a taboo topic. I think a lot of people don't want to talk about it, particularly sexual abuse. I remember working in schools and wanting to alert teachers to the signs that children won't come forward and say something necessarily, but there might be signs to pay attention to. And it's so uncomfortable for people, especially given the stats. You know, what is it, 1 in 3 girls, perhaps, by the time they're 18, and 1 in 6 to 8 boys. That stat is weak because boys are not helped to come forward, but will have some degree of sexual violence in their life. So I think things have improved. I think Oprah's helped, honestly, where she did a lot of work trying to bring men forward, and then she had black men come forward, all black men, where it's really very taboo to talk about it, kept on the quote down low. I think there's been some movement. I don't believe that the stats are any better, though. I just think that there's more awareness. Having said that, I don't think we're far enough you're the psychiatrist in private practice. You're much more aware of this than I, but I don't think we're far enough around creating space where it's safe for boys and men to come forward, A, because of homophobia. And also, the belief is if it was a woman who did it or an older girl who did it to a guy, the belief is, you lucky bastard. You know, this whole macho sort of thing. So that silences boys and men to say, actually, she forced herself on me. You know, then that's not cool to do. And if it was a man or an older boy, what are you, gay? What are you, a fag? Like, you must like him. You must have attracted him. You must have made him think that he could do that to you, man. And those two things haven't shifted. So until these sort of things shift, I don't know if we can call things better, but, yeah.
You know, I really do agree with you, Cheryl. I think that on the real nitty-gritty level, not a lot has changed. I think some social aspects have changed. Obviously, I think the police in general in the U.S. now, if there's a domestic dispute, they walk into a woman with a black eye and an angry male, they're not just going to ignore it anymore or side with the male.
Uh-huh.
I think there have been some structural changes like that. But on the nitty-gritty level you're talking about, not much. Again, there's been a huge structural change in gay marriage in the U.S., and that is making people much more aware of issues of the common humanity of all of us. But I think you're right, as I think about on the nitty-gritty level, you're still not going to have boys and men coming forward, for example, and talking about being sexually abused. Almost never, mm-hmm. And rarely will women. And it's even in therapy, it's a subject that that requires a real encouragement to come forward. So, mm-hmm. I think you're absolutely right about the limitations on the progress that has been made.
Well, you know, a while ago, maybe 2 years, 3 years, you would know better, maybe five. Was that whole movement of this so-called false memory syndrome that then, you know, pushed men and women who had experienced childhood sexual abuse back inside, back quiet, because, you know, there's these false memory syndrome people that were purporting to suggest that people were coming up with false memories, that somehow they must have been influenced or it hit their subconscious and now they were dreaming up stories that so-and-so sexually abused them when they were kids. I think that silenced a lot of survivors, of childhood sexual abuse survivors. And the reality is, of course, as you know better than most people, the memories of childhood sexual abuse are fuzzy, are with holes in them, are, fuzzy at best. So, I don't know, there's so many ways that we're silencing people to come forward and speak of their distress. And, and of course, you know, to suggest that the answer to distress is to use electroshock is just another form of violence. It's state-sanctioned violence. It's oppressive. It's damaging. It's frightening. It's scary. And that's how you and I really began to get closer, is when we started to realize how little was written stating, why would you ever place electricity on a child's brain? Why would we ever even consider doing that? We must not do that. And that's why you and I and a couple of other scholars decided to take a chance and write an article that landed on an absolute call for an absolute ban on it. So, yeah.
Well, I don't want to take any credit for initiating it, because, of course, I came in when you called me and just wanted some of my help and advice, and
yes,
I think you were so pleased to at my response, and I was so pleased to be asked that
absolutely
that you were kind enough to include me in as one of the joint authors. why don't you go ahead and mention the article and roughly when it might be coming out?
I wish I knew roughly when it's coming out, so because it's a UK publication. I know that, you know, there's all kinds of edits we've gone through, and the way that we wanted to say things is different in the UK. You're not really meant expected to be as forthright, if you will. You're supposed to be a much more subdued in ways. But the argument that we're coming forward is that there's a belief out there that children don't get electroshock, and if ever children would ever get electroshock, it would be, A, the last resort, and B, it would be based on an extreme prudence and only under the utmost discretion of really knowledgeable teams of people who place the best interests of the child in the center. And the belief that decisions about electroshock are going to be rooted in discretion and prudence, we are arguing that it leaves children vulnerable to shock, susceptible to electroshock. And so using all of your decades of scientific proof of the damage that electroshock does to brains, we're using that as our strong, strong argument. Why would you ever, on a developing brain, never mind anybody's brain, but why would you ever, on a developing brain, why would we ever place basically tasers on a child's brain and suggest that it was, quote, therapeutic? So I believe that it is going to be accepted. I know that the editors really, really wanted this to happen. And you know, when I first called you, I was worried about how we were going to do this. How can we write it in a way that it can get published without selling ourselves short, without watering down the truth? The truth that all of Dr. Bregan, you have done, all of the proof that you've amassed, and we decided to root it in the United Nations Convention on the Rights of Children, and use arguments within that to strengthen the already strong argument that electroshock is damaging and violent and maleficent. So I'm just hopeful, and I don't know, you're not taking enough credit, but as soon as you came on board, the strength of the argument was tenfold at minimum. And people pay attention to what you have to say because you back everything up 6, 7, 8, 9 different ways. And I actually find you brave, you courageous to be, when I speak about you in my classes now, because I teach a Women in Madness course at York University now. It's the first one at the university. And I rely so much on your Truth About Psychiatry videos to center the class, to center them in off of the hegemonic discourse out there that's perpetuated by pharmaceutical industries and then further perpetuated by my own profession and by your own profession. So I really do rely heavily on you. You're actually very present every Tuesday evening in Toronto. You're actually right there.
That's very nice.
Yeah, well, you know, it's so courageous of you to do this, to put yourself out there, to keep your feet in psychiatry because of how you know that empathic-based psychiatry is the answer, is the most helpful. You are keeping your foot in there and trying to shift your profession, the lenses that frame your profession, while taking hits all the time by people who would argue that your arguments are not correct.
When did you first learn about my work? I always like to remember to ask my visitors
first,
that.
Yeah, I first learned about it. You see, Bonnie Burstow at up in Toronto, who is an anti-psychiatry scholar, she was one of my advisors on my PhD. And so she's the one who first got me to start looking at, I first looked at Foucault and the whole history of madness and how it's a social construct. And then because I am a nurse and was a nurse, I wanted to see scientific stuff. I wanted to see who's arguing, who's making these arguments that it is problematic, that these so-called treatments of chemical straitjacketing or chemical anesthetization of people's distress, who's arguing that this is actually maleficent? And it was you. You know, there's a couple of other terrific people that are doing this, but you are unrelenting, just unrelenting. I told you when I first started chatting with you last Christmas, you're a machine by how much you write, but it's because you want to make sure that this argument stays central, is not marginalized. And the more I read of your work, the more I wanted to try and make a change within nursing. And so that's where I've tried to take this work back, is to come back and bring these truths back to my own profession and ask my profession to take a sober second or third look, to realize how we are otherwise being complicit. When I hand a medication to somebody and I don't disclose all the dangerous side effects, I'm complicit. You know, and when I accompany somebody down to get electroshock, I am complicit. When I clean the goo off their head or take the electrodes off or help them to pee because they can't after electroshock, I'm complicit. It's not, I can't just say, oh, I'm, you know, it's not me, I'm just a nurse. You know, doctor, whoever is a doctor, it's their responsibility. No, it isn't. It just isn't. So it's been good and challenging to bring these arguments back, but I'm not going to stop. And now that I'm tenured out of university, I wasn't worried before, but I'm more, I guess, able to speak up and speak out. And so what we're trying to create in at York, and hoping it'll become a Canadian journal, is a new journal called Witness, Canadian Journal of Critical Discourse in Nursing. And it's to be an online, completely open-access journal where no one has to sort of subscribe for money, where critical voices in nursing can finally find space of a journal that will publish it. So if somebody wants to say, you know, using restraints on people is against my code of ethics, it's very hard to get that published. So that's what my work with you has given me the courage to try and do. I don't know how to start a journal. I just know we don't have one. We don't have enough spaces, if you will, where our profession can have a critical lens on health, on healthcare, on treatment. So I want to be able to have that up and going before I retire. But it'll happen before then, I hope. So, yeah. So,
well, if you want any MDs associated with your essentially a nurse's journal, I'd be happy to lend whatever I can to that. And
that'd be wonderful.
And maybe, you know, it would be wonderful to come up to York University now that you have tenure and have a conference together up there.
That really would be terrific. We could do that with the Critical Disabilities Program, who has a subgroup around MAD studies, and that's Jeffrey Reum and Nancy Davis Halifax, who are both anti-psychiatry scholars. We could do that with those terrific folks who
Well, that's wonderful. Maybe even with a partial or co-sponsorship with our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of good things we could do together.
Yeah.
You know, partially inspired by working with you recently, I took a big chunk of my time out, and I've created this website. Now, you know about it, but I want the listeners to know about it. And it's called ECT Resources, ectresources.org. And I have just brought together, you know, innumerable scientific articles, got them all up in PDFs. I've got them linked back to search items, so you can search women or abuse or brain damage or cognitive dysfunction or banning ECT. And it even has a color brochure you can print out as a brochure to give to families and other people who may be facing ECT or just thinking about it. And you can also print out the brochure just as a little essay. I just feel so strongly about stopping this oppressive, brain-damaging practice that I just did that recently. And I hope people will look it up and spread the word around. It's entirely free, and really make use of this resource, because there has been nothing like it before.
Okay.
I'm glad that's there.
Yeah.
We have about a minute left. Let me give the mic right back to you, and any summary thoughts, Cheryl, that you have.
I guess what I want to say is if there are nurses who are listening to this, is that it's time that we start to come together and support one another to speak the unpopular, speak the unsafe, because otherwise it eats away at us. And, so maybe there's a way that we can create sort of a network between Canada and the States and start bringing together the brave nurses that I know that are out there that are wanting to, give voice to those who otherwise aren't listened to. And to thank you, too, Peter, for all the work that you do and for asking me to come on. I feel honored. Thank you.
Thank you. Your timing is marvelous. Cheryl Van Dalen Smith. That's Dalen Smith. It's D-A-A-L-E-N hyphen Smith. Dr. Cheryl Van Dalen Smith, Associate Professor, School of Nursing, York University, Director of the Graduate Program in Interdisciplinary Studies. Thanks for being on the Dr. Peter Brinkenhour.
Thanks, Peter. Take care.
Bye.